Chapter 7. China, her hair is from, I don't know where her hair is from. I never could find out. That is, her other hair, her public hair, her Sunday hair. I don't mean the hair she goes to bed with. And that reminds me of a trifle. Anytime you want to, you can glance around the carpet of a Pullman car and go and pick up a hairpin. But not to save your life can you get any woman in that car to acknowledge that hairpin. Now, isn't that strange? But it's true. The woman who has never swerved from cast iron veracity and fidelity in her whole life will, when confronted with this crucial test, deny her hairpin. She will deny that hairpin before 100 witnesses. I have stupidly got into more trouble and more hot water trying to hunt up the owner of a hairpin in a Pullman than by any other indiscretion of my life. Dress reform and copyright. When the present copyright law was under discussion, Mr. Clemens appeared before the committee. He had sent Speaker Cannon the following letter. Dear Uncle Joseph, please get me the thanks of Congress, not next week but right away. It is very necessary. Do accomplish this for your affectionate old friend right away by persuasion if you can, by violence if you must, for it is imperatively necessary that I get on the floor of the House for 2 or 3 hours and talk to the members, man by man, in behalf of support, encouragement, and protection of one of the nation's most valuable assets and industries, its literature. I have arguments with me also a barrel with liquid in it. I've me a chance. Get me the thanks of Congress. Don't wait for others, there isn't time. Furnish them to me yourself, and let Congress ratify later. I have stayed away, and let Congress alone for 71 years, and am entitled to the thanks. Congress knows this perfectly well, and I have long felt hurt that this quite proper and earned expression of gratitude has been merely felt by the House, and never publicly uttered. End me an order on the sergeant-at-arms quick. When shall I come? If love and a benediction, Ark Twain. While waiting to appear before the committee, my Clemens talked to the reporters. Why don't you ask why I am wearing such apparently unseasonable clothes? I'll tell you. I have found that, when a man reaches the advanced age of 71 years, as I have, the continual sight of dark clothing is likely to have a depressing effect upon him. Light-colored clothing is more pleasing to the eye and enlivens the spirit. Now, of course, I cannot compel everyone to wear such clothing just for my especial benefit, so I do the next best thing and wear it myself. Of course, before a man reaches my years, the fear of criticism might prevent him from indulging his fancy. I am not afraid of that. I am decidedly for pleasing color combinations in dress. I like to see the women's clothes, say, at the opera. What can be more depressing than the somber black which custom requires men to wear upon state occasions? A group of men in evening clothes looks like a flock of crows, and is just about as inspiring. After all, what is the purpose of clothing? Are not clothes intended primarily to preserve dignity and also to afford comfort to their wearer? Now I know of nothing more uncomfortable than the present-day clothes of men. The finest clothing made is a person's own skin, but, of course, society demands something more than this. The best-dressed man I have ever seen, however, was a native of the Sandwich Islands who attracted my attention 30 years ago. Now, when that man wanted to don a special dress to honor a public occasion or a holiday, why, he occasionally put on a pair of spectacles. Otherwise the clothing with which God had provided him sufficed. Of course, I have ideas of dress reform. For one thing, why not adopt some of the women's styles? Goodness knows, they adopt enough of ours. Take the peekaboo waist, for instance. It has the obvious advantages of being cool and comfortable, and in addition it is almost always made up in pleasing colors which cheer and do not depress. It is true that I dressed the Connecticut Yankee at King Arthur's court in a plug hat, but, let's see, that was 25 years ago. Then no man was considered fully dressed until he donned a plug hat. Nowadays I think that no man is dressed until he leaves at home. Why, when I left home yesterday they trotted out a plug hat for me to wear. You must wear it, they told me. Why, just think of going to Washington without a plug hat. But I said no, I would wear a derby or nothing. Why, I believe I could walk along the streets of New York, I never do, but still I think I could, and I should never see a well-dressed man wearing a plug hat. If I did, I should suspect him of something. I don't know just what, but I would suspect him. Why, when I got up on the second story of that Pennsylvania ferry boat coming down here yesterday, I saw Howells coming along. He was the only man on the boat with a plug hat, and I tell you he felt ashamed of himself. He said he had been persuaded to wear it against his better sense. But just think of a man nearly 70 years old who has not a mind of his own on such matters. Are you doing any work now? The youngest and most serious reporter asked. Work? I retired from work on my 70th birthday. Since then I have been putting in nearly 26 hours a day dictating my autobiography, which, as John Phoenix said in regard to his autograph, may be relied upon as authentic, as it is written exclusively by me. But it is not to be published in full until I am thoroughly dead. I have made it as caustic, fiendish, and devilish as possible. It will fill many volumes, and I shall continue writing it until the time comes for me to join the angels. It is going to be a terrible autobiography. It will make the hair of some folks curl. But it cannot be published until I am dead, and the persons mentioned in it and their children and grandchildren are dead. It is something awful. Can you tell us the names of some of the notables that are here to see you off? I don't know. I am so shy. My shyness takes a peculiar phase. I never look a person in the face. The reason is that I am afraid they may know me, and that I may not know them, which makes it very embarrassing for both of us. I always wait for the other person to speak. I know lots of people, but I don't know who they are. It is all a matter of ability to observe things. I never observe anything now. I gave up the habit years ago. You should keep a habit up, if you want to become proficient in it. For instance, I was a pilot once, but I gave it up, and I do not believe the captain of the Minneapolis would let me navigate his ship to London. Still, if I think that he is not on the job, I may go up on the bridge and offer him a few suggestions. College girls, 500 undergraduates, under the auspices of the Women's University Club New York, welcomed Mr. Clemens as their guest, April 3, 1906, and gave him the freedom of the club, which the chairman explained was freedom to talk individually to any girl present. I've worked for the public good 30 years, so for the rest of my life I shall work for my personal contentment. I am glad Miss Nearand has fed me, for there is no telling what iniquity I might wander into on an empty stomach, an empty mind. I am going to tell you a practical story about how once upon a time I was blind, a story I should have been using all these months, but I never thought about telling it until the other night, and now it is too late, for on the 19th of this month I hope to take formal leave of the platform forever at Carnegie Hall, that is, take leave so far as talking for money, and for people who have paid money to hear me talk. I shall continue to infest the platform on these conditions: that there is nobody in the house who has paid to hear me, that I am not paid to be heard, and that there will be none but young women students in the audience. Here Mr. Clemens told the story of how he took a girl to the theater while he was wearing tight boots, which appears elsewhere in this volume, and ended by saying, "And now let this be a lesson to you." I don't know what kind of a lesson. I'll let you think it out. Girls, in my capacity of publisher I recently received a manuscript from a teacher which embodied a number of answers given by her pupils to questions propounded. These answers show that the children had nothing but the sound, to go by the sense was perfectly empty. Here are some of their answers to words they were asked to define. Auriferous, pertaining to amorphous. Ammonia, the food of the gods. Equestrian, one who asks questions. Parasite, a kind of umbrella. Ipecac, a man who likes a good dinner. And here is the definition of an ancient word honored by a great party. Republican, a sinner mentioned in the Bible. And here is an innocent deliverance of a zoological kind colon. There are a good many donkeys in the theological gardens. Here also is a definition which really isn't very bad in its way. Demagogue, a vessel containing beer and other liquids. Here too, is a sample of a boy's composition on girls, which, I must say, I rather like. Girls are very stuck up and dignified in their manner and behavior. They think more of dress than anything, and like to play with dowels and rags. They cry if they see a cow in a far distance, and are afraid of guns. They stay at home all the time, and go to church every Sunday. They are always sick. They are always furry and making fun of boys' hands, and they say how dirty. They can't play marbles. I pity them, poor things. They make fun of boys, and then turn round and love them. I don't believe they ever killed a cat or anything. They look out every night and say, oh, ain't the moon lovely. There is one thing I have not told, and that is they always know their lessons better than boys. The ladies, delivered at the anniversary festival, 1872, of the Scottish Corporation of London, Mr. Clemens replied to the toast, he ladies. I am proud, indeed, of the distinction of being chosen to respond to this special toast, to ye ladies, or to women if you please, for that is the preferable term, perhaps. It is certainly the older, and therefore the more entitled to reverence. I have noticed that the Bible, with that plain, blunt honesty which is such a conspicuous characteristic of the Scriptures, is always particular to never refer to even the illustrious mother of all mankind as a Addie, but speaks of her as a woman. It is odd, but you will find it is so. I am peculiarly proud of this honor, because I think that the toast to women is one which, by right and by every rule of gallantry, should take precedence of all others, of the army, of the navy, of even royalty itself, perhaps, though the latter is not necessary in this day and in this land, for the reason that, tacitly, you do drink a broad general health to all good women, when you drink the health of the Queen of England and the Princess of Wales. I have in mind a poem just now which is familiar to you all, familiar to everybody. And what an inspiration that was, and how instantly the present toast recalls the verses to all our minds when the most noble, the most gracious, the purest, and sweetest of all poets says, Omen, O woman, Erwam, however, you remember the lines, and you remember how feelingly, how daintily, how almost imperceptibly the verses raise up before you, feature by feature, the ideal of a true and perfect woman, and how, as you contemplate the finished marvel, your homage grows into worship of the intellect that could create so fair a thing out of mere breath, mere words. And you call to mind now, as I speak, how the poet, with stern fidelity to the history of all humanity, delivers this beautiful child of his heart and his brain over to the trials and sorrows that must come to all, sooner or later, that abide in the earth, and how the pathetic story culminates in that apostrophe so wild, so regretful, so full of mournful retrospection. The lines run thus. Loss. Alas. A alas, 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 and so on. I do not remember the rest, but, taken together, it seems to me that poem is the noblest tribute to woman that human genius has ever brought forth, and I feel that, if I were to talk hours I could not do my great theme completer or more graceful justice than I have now done in simply quoting that poet's matchless words. The phases of the womanly nature are infinite in their variety. Take any type of woman, and you shall find in it something to respect, something to admire, something to love. And you shall find the whole joining you heart and hand. Who was more patriotic than Joan of Arc? Who was braver? who has given us a grander instance of self-sacrificing devotion. Ah! You remember well, what a throb of pain, what a great tidal wave of grief swept over us all, when Joan of Arc fell at Waterloo. Who does not sorrow for the loss of Sappho, the sweet singer of Israel? Who among us does not miss the gentle ministrations, the softening influences, the humble piety of Lucretia Borgia? Who can join in the heartless libel that says woman is extravagant in dress, when he can look back and call to mind our simple and lowly mother Eve arrayed in her modification of the island costume? Sir, women have been soldiers, women have been painters, women have been poets. As long as language lives, the name of Cleopatra will live. And not because she conquered George III, but because she wrote those divine lines. Et dogs delight to bark and bite, for God hath made them so. The story of the world is adorned with the names of illustrious ones of our own sex, some of them sons of St. Andrew, to Scott, Bruce, Burns, the warrior Wallace, Ben Nevis, the gifted Ben Lomond, and the great new Scotchman, Ben Disraeli. Mr. Benjamin Disraeli, at that time Prime Minister of England, had just been elected Lord Rector of Glasgow University, and had made a speech which gave rise to a world of discussion. Out of the great plains of history tower whole mountain ranges of sublime women. The Queen of Sheba, Josephine, Semiramis, Sarigamp. The list is endless, but I will not call the mighty roll. The names rise up in your own memories at the mere suggestion, luminous with the glory of deeds that cannot die, hallowed by the loving worship of the good and the true of all epochs and all climes. Suffice it for our pride and our honor that we in our day have added to it such names as those of Grace Darling and Florence Nightingale. Woman is all that she should be: gentle, patient, long-suffering, trustful, unselfish, full of generous impulses. It is her blessed mission to comfort the sorrowing, plead for the erring, encourage the faint of purpose, succor the distressed, uplift the fallen, befriend the friendless, in a word, afford the healing of her sympathies, and a home in her heart for all the bruised and persecuted children that knock at its hospitable door. And when I say, God bless her, there is none among us who has known the ennobling affection of a wife, or the steadfast devotion of a mother, but in his heart will say, Amen. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.